from the one-dimensional harmonic oscillator. You're just saying, well, the same, you can treat at least the free, like, say, the free scalar field mode. For each mode, you can just treat like the one-dimensional harmonic oscillator and then set up kind of the Hilbert space of your theory, which contains states with arbitrary numbers of particles. And that's, of course, what distinguishes quantum field theory from quantum mechanics. Okay, I emphasize a little bit the essential structures that are always there in the quantum field theory, so the relativistic quantum field theories, I should say, which live on a Minkowski space, and that Minkowski space has a symmetry, leaving four-dimensional Minkowskian scalar products invariant, namely that of Poincaré transformations. And what you always require is that these are unitarily represented in the quantum field theory. And we looked a little bit at how this looks for the graviton states. So say just to make life simple for one particle, so one graviton state. So they have, of course, a momentum label, but they have this additional helicity label also. And we, at least I wrote down the relations for you, how they behave under the unitary transformation that knows about, well, the Lorentz boost or a transformation in the four spacetime directions. So then basically you have the setting for perturbative quantum gravity, if you like, in a path integral context. And we'll get to this a little later today and also tomorrow. And I basically finished writing down an expression for the perturbative, I mean the linearized field and its operator analog, so that was the F mu hat, essentially takes the form of a kind of Fourier decomposition over these individual modes. And the only thing you have to pay attention to is this additional information about the polarization that is contained in this, was contained in this unit polarization tensor E hat mu nu. Okay, so for today I promised to tell you a little bit about, well, how physical, really, these gravitons are that appear. I mean, just von Arrhenius, of course, completely in analogy with, say, scalar field theory and what one does here. And especially there's one person who's been keeping asking this question, that is Freeman Dyson. And namely, can one actually detect with any kind of conceivable experiment to be done in our universe, so that doesn't narrow things down very much, at least, you know, for the more conservative types, can one detect single gravitons in any conceivable way? There's an experiment done here. So let me just pose this question at the outset. So is it possible in principle? Is it possible in practice? If not, what does that mean? So do gravitons kind of actually exist if one cannot detect them? Of course, the first thing one might think of is to say, well, you know, we've learned about these gravitational wave detectors. So that already brings us pretty close to this language, you know, of thinking of gravitons, or, of course, in this case, of states made up of many, many gravitons. So just to get an idea, let us just check out kind of the energy content of a typical gravitational wave, and kind of divide this by H bar omega. So that's kind of the energy of a graviton. And let's see what this number is. So then you have to, first of all, put in kind of what is a typical gravitational, the amplitude of a typical gravitational wave we expect to see here or to detect here on Earth coming from, you know, a strong signal. So what are our gravitational wave detectors? What kind of signal are they tuned to? What do they help to detect? And so just to give you a few numbers to convey an idea of the orders of magnitude, so a typical gravitational wave amplitude say coming from a supernova or something, is of the order of 10 to the minus 20. So that is very small, obviously, and that, of course, has all to do with the weakness of gravity. Omega for such signals is on the order of 1 kilohertz, and the wavelength accordingly on the order of 3 × 10⁵ meters. Now, if one now compares the energy, as I said, with that of a single graviton, kind of a typical number one finds for graviton density, so by which I mean kind of graviton number density, in such contained in such a wave, kind of on average, then we get that this is a stunning 10 to the 37 per wavelength cubed. It's kind of a reference volume I would like to look at. And this is about, if you want to look at smaller units, it's still 3 × 10⁴ per cubic centimeters. And you see, these are enormous numbers in terms of single gravitons. So in other words, with any the information that comes out of these detectors, we will not be able to make any statement whatsoever about single graviton events. Yeah, a couple of questions. Here? None. It's like the metric. Like it's the F mu. So it's compared to the typical magnitude of entries. I mean, at least that's how we've been using the units. You know, it's the F mu, the little F mu. Yeah.
So how would this translate to numbers? Like, if I have a 1 meter long stick, how much would that like stretch and shrink because of this kind of a wave?
Oh, it's just minuscule.
How could I calculate?
Like with a bar, if it was a bar detector? You mean like a bar detector?
Yeah, because that's what they're doing, right?
Sure, with laser. Exactly. That's right. Yeah, it's just a minuscule signal, which you just, well, you can enhance by kind of, you know, mirror kind of interferometric setups. But it's incredibly small.
Could I calculate that with these numbers?
Well, you just need to know, the gravitational wave signal. Could you calculate it with these numbers? If you're good, probably, yes. Well, there's no way it comes from, of course. It comes from a specific framework which describes, I mean, all properties of these waves, not just the energy content. Yes, you certainly get an idea of the order of magnitude here. So that won't do very much for us in terms of kind of single gravitons. It's actually, one can look at this, there are people who have looked at this somewhat more systematically, and there are various subtleties in the analysis, but kind of the bottom line being that really this doesn't seem to be possible. So let me just, you know, for your entertainment, summarize a few of these results, and they are, well, recently published ones are due to a couple of people, Bohn and Rothman, and you can read up on them in 2 preprints on GRQC 06, 01, 043, and 06, 05, 052. So they were inspired by this explicit question to think about this. And so one of the things they say is, well, we cannot really think of any reason why it should be impossible in principle. However, now we come to the in practice, and there things look quite a bit different. So the first statement is, well, one can kind of think of kind of concocting a thought experiment involving kind of an idealized detector. The detector is of Jupiter size. So that's not something very handy to operate with. Why is it not larger than Jupiter to start with? Because, well, you have to be careful if you make the thing too big, so it will just collapse under its own gravity. So that's also not a situation. That's a situation you want to avoid. So putting in this detector and assuming, it's of course a ridiculous assumption, it has 100% efficiency. There's no noise for that tiny a signal you want to look for. And then they come to the conclusion, well, okay, maybe you can detect, the occasional graviton that comes by. Now, however, once you make this more realistic, so you really, you go to, you say, well, even if you only try to make it kind of remotely realistic by taking into account, the non-efficiency of the detector and the fact that there are actually huge contributions from noise from all kinds of sources because that signal is just so weak. Then our conclusion is there is just no detector in the world you could even think of in terms of thought experiment, which would you allow to detect any gravitons. So that's, let me just finish this story. So that's kind of the detection part of the thing. Of course, another thing you have to think of is kind of, well, what kind of signal am I going to observe? Where are these gravitons? What are the sources of these gravitons which I want to detect in the first place? And there are a few kind of natural possibilities they consider. And of course, then the question is, well, what is their strength? What is the strength of these signals? And so they give one of the examples is that you could consider just kind of a single atom, take a hydrogen atom for simplicity. You could consider a transition of one of the electrons spontaneous emission of a photon, whereby the electron jumps back to, say, the ground state. So that's kind of, and you can compute the transition rate for that, due to electromagnetism. But this might also be conceivably just be induced by the gravitational interaction. And you do a completely analogous kind of calculation of that emission rate. And the number you come up with is as follows. So that is the transition rate, right? Kind of a spontaneous graviton emission in a hydrogen atom. Kind of jumping from the d orbital to the ground state, and what one finds, well, let me write down this number. So this stands, the little g stands for gravity. This rate is 5.7 times 10 to the minus 14 per second. Now, again, this is just a ridiculously small number. So if you, just to get an idea, you compare that to the analogous rate for spontaneous photon, it's 47 orders of magnitude smaller. Okay, so again, that is not a very realistic source, for graviton emission. And so it continues, with other mechanisms I can think of. It's just the numbers are always so incredibly small that they don't hesitate in concluding, well, it's very unlikely that you can pinpoint any detection of a single photon within our universe. So they answer this question with no. It doesn't seem to be possible. Now, of course, the issue is now what implications does that have? Can one jump to the conclusion that there is no such thing as quantum gravity, even if kind of single gravitons are out of reach? I think that's not the right conclusion necessarily. Obviously, it illustrates the weakness of these things, but of course, there can be other phenomenological implications which don't depend on individual gravitons kind of being realized or detectable in nature. So some other kind of cumulative process. So I don't think that is an argument you can use to say, well, quantum gravity doesn't exist. But clearly it illustrates that it's an uphill battle trying to link that to phenomenology. Okay. So much about the gravitons. Now, the next thing I want to embark on is the path integral. I mean, to start with, of course, you know, we've talked about Fock space, we've introduced Fock space. So that's now really the setting to do perturbative quantum gravity in. Before doing this, I first of all want to make a few remarks about contrasting kind of canonical methods with covariant, so-called covariant path integral methods, because also these are two distinct ways in which one can do quantum gravity. And then, you know, recap a few properties of the gravitational path integral before then just presenting you with some of the properties of the perturbative version of that path integral, before we then move on to kind of a less perturbative analysis of the issue. Okay, so there's a big heading is gravitational path integral. But with, to start with, some introductory remarks. Okay, the first, of course, we always fall back onto either the harmonic oscillator or the free non-relativistic particle, talking about quantum mechanics. So let me look at the latter. So just consider non-relativistic particle in three dimensions, say. In a canonical formulation, the system is defined, the dynamics takes place on a classical phase space, spanned by kind of three coordinate pairs x, I, p, I running from 1 to 3, and these Poisson bracket relations, of course, we had already written down for the one-dimensional harmonic oscillator yesterday. They look like this. An xi with a pj gives you a delta ij. And these Poisson brackets are, of course, they're an operation that is defined on arbitrary functions on phase space. So again, think of xi and pi as just special examples of functions, namely the coordinate functions on that phase space. Now, Hamiltonians, easily written down, m half x vector dot squared plus, well, if I have a potential, it's here, a sufficiently simple potential to allow me to do my calculations. I quantize it by putting heads on everything. Well, in a manner of speaking, I'll get a bunch of self-adjoint or Hermitian operators, xi hat, pi hat, and of course what I always need is a quantum Hamiltonian. They live on a Hilbert space, and the Hilbert space is just given by standard square integral functions on R3, well, with respect to the flat measure dx. And what were the canonical Poisson brackets in the classical theory goes over to the canonical commutator brackets, x I hat with pj hat equal to I h bar delta ij, analogous to what we had before. And if you, that's essentially a unique representation of these in the quantum theory. That's kind of the Schrödinger representation up to unitary equivalence, where the xi is represented by multiplication with xi, and the pi hat is just a partial differential I h bar d by dxi. Not sure. You probably can't. You have already difficulties seeing this below here. Okay, I squeeze in the Hamiltonian down here. H hat is just by sticking in these expressions, I get a kinetic term minus h bar squared divided by 2m. Delta plus V of x. x hat. Well, x really in this representation. Again, what does it mean to solve the quantum dynamics? It just means to find the eigenstate of this Hamiltonian. In other words, to solve the Schrödinger equation, in the simple case, this boils down to finding solutions to h hat psi of x equal to e psi of x. So eigenvalue equation with respect to the energies. Well, now E are just possible eigenvalues, energy eigenvalues. Now, equivalently to this construction, or once you have the Hamiltonian, having the Hamiltonian, the quantum Hamiltonian, also defines, just by taking, you know, E to the I H hat T, defines a unitary evolution operator depending on the time t. T, so that gets you from a time t naught to time t, and is given by e to the minus I h hat times t minus t naught divided by h bar. So this is elementary stuff. So this is, you know, just to find that back in the recesses of your brain. This is simple quantum mechanics in principle. So what does this evolution operator do for me in order to understand what the wave function is at some time t, given what it was at some earlier time t naught? I'll just apply this unitary operator. Now, often I'm interested in specific, in preparing or looking at my states in a specific representation, say the position representation. Yeah. So what I then do, I consider, first of all, a basis of such vectors, say position eigenstates. Just labeled by a three-dimensional position vector. And they are, of course, as you well know, they're improper eigenstates of the position vector x hat. Improper because they're not, strictly speaking, a square integral, of course. Now, making my wave functions kind of explicitly x-dependent, I can write this as a kind of in bracket notation as bra x vector with ket my wave function psi of t. And Now, if I want to use, if I now multiply this through, or if I take the scalar product here, a ket, with this entire equation, or say a ket x prime, I can write then this relation in the following way, psi x prime t equal to right hand side x prime evolution operator u of t t naught psi of t naught, and now inserting a so-called resolution of unity in here, I can write this as an integral, three-dimensional x integral, now with some new kind of auxiliary variable x, which I call x double prime. So the first two pieces I copy from here, u x prime, u t t naught, and now comes my insertion, the x2 double prime, and x2 double prime psi of t naught. And that's, of course, by definition, that is my psi x double prime t naught. So what I've done is I have rewritten the evolution equation now for the wave function in the x representation. Okay. And you see here on the right-hand side, this is kind of, well, it's an integration. I've picked up a non-trivial integration. And this object here now contains, of course, the information about the time evolution. So, and this object has various names. It's called the propagator, or the Feynman kernel, and, well, for our, so really, this is the thing that knows about the Hamiltonian. And what is interesting for our purposes, for the argument I want to make, is that this object has a path integral representation. Yeah. And, well, knowing this object, what this is actually equivalent to, kind of, to knowing, you know, the quantum Hamiltonian. So this object, so let me give this a star, this relation, or this, so sometimes it's called G of x prime t x double prime t naught. Right, so this, you know, where it comes from kind of initially and where it kind of propagates to, the x and the t coordinates. So this thing has a path integral representation, by which I mean the following: e to the minus I h hat t divided by h bar of x. So with these specific arguments, and of course, if I have a time independent Hamiltonian, this object will only depend also on the difference between t and t naught. So that's already kind of captured here. Now, path integral representation means that I can write it in the following way, kind of formally, as a sum over all paths x of t, where I've fixed the initial point of all those paths, x of 0, t equal to 0, to be my vector x. So that is this argument here. And the x of t, so the endpoint of my evolution, coincides with the argument x prime that appears here. And what is the integrand? It's an e to the I divided by h bar s of x and t. So let me now say a few things about to remind you what this object is. So it's a functional integral. So it's not, that's what this kind of curly D is about. So you take, you know, any path between x and x prime, you just pin down the endpoints, you keep those fixed, and otherwise the path can be anything. And what you're then supposed to do is for each of these paths compute the action. And of course the action is just an integral over the entire path, so it's a kind of it's the entire non-information is non-locally integrated, and of course the entire path is relevant, so that's also why one chooses this functional way of writing it, and then, well, add them all up or integrate them all up. So that's what you're supposed to do. Of course, in practice, what does this look like in practice for the simple quantum mechanical path integral? So first of all, let me just write down the continuum expression for the case of the non-relativistic particle for the action S of x of t, or simply the integral from 0 to t with respect to a time parameter t prime, m half x dot squared minus v of x, whatever that potential v was. So that is the classical action for the path in its entire kind of glory, x of t. And of course, it's what I do here. I integrate over all paths. I mean, I have to, of course, specify what all means, but one should emphasize not just over classical solutions. I mean, these paths, they can be anything. They need to have nothing to do at all with the classical solutions of that system. So one way, which I'm sure you're familiar with, of how to really define what one means by this in a, you know, halfway mathematically well-defined and clean way is to start by looking at specific at a class of simple paths, which are piecewise straight paths, and then kind of take a continuum limit of those. So let me remind you how this goes. So the way to get to this equation star here is really from a specific limiting process. Where I consider initially, so let this be kind of my time direction vertically here, and let this be kind of symbolically my three x directions along the horizontal axis here. So let this be the initial point, my x of 0 equal to the distinguished point x, and my endpoint, well, that would be somewhere here, that is the x of t, and this I called x prime, so that is a specific point, that is also a specific point. And what one then does is to approximate, first of all, the set of all paths by dividing up the time interval t into n equal steps. Okay, so that is kind of a delta t. Each of these is some identical time interval delta t, which is t divided just by n. So n is just the number of slices, the number of time intervals I choose to divide this up into. And now I just consider paths that at each kind of integer value or integer multiple of this delta t just have some arbitrary x value. And by definition, I connect them up with a piecewise, with a straight segment. Okay, so that is a possible path. This is another possible path. And so forth. Okay? Sorry, no, this has to end, of course, at my chosen path. So you see, I get a specific for each value of n. Well, I get a specific class of piecewise linear or piecewise straight or, you know, anticipating kind of gravitational language, a piecewise flat path. I mean, it's straight with respect to the, you know, underlying Euclidean metric here. So, and what one then does, this limiting process consists in letting delta t go to zero. And what is, of course, equivalent, or what goes hand in hand with letting capital N, the number of divisions here, go to infinity. So from a limiting process, and for each of the finite value of these numbers, you integrate over these piecewise straight paths. Piecewise straight, piecewise flat path, consisting of capital N segments. And now, why does that make my life easier? Of course, if I think, you know, in the continuum of a general path, I would have in mind, you know, some kind of smooth object that kind of winds and curves here as a function of time, back and forth. Now, from the point of view of geometry, these are much easier objects to work with. In particular, there is a nice way kind of discretizing this action, namely by simply taking here for this velocity squared part, finite differences, you know, between pairs of points. And here, the v of x will be just the v, you know, at a chosen value x at t1, at t2, etc. So there is a this certainly has a simple functional form and is actually something you can handle in a concrete computation. Almost, that is. Now, I won't do it for you here, because this is really part of a standard quantum mechanics introductory quantum field theory course of the type, I guess, you've been taught here already by, for example, by François Davy. So this should be familiar. What you should pay attention to, or note, perhaps, is, you see, this came, of course, here from the Hamiltonian, right? So, but the Hamiltonian was, of course, kinetic plus potential term. But, well, just because of how details work out, this, to start with discrete expression, and how you do this integration explicitly for finite n, you see, the end result, so taking the continuum limit of that then, gives you something that looks like kinetic minus potential energy, so the action. But of course, you can trace it explicitly through the calculation, when you do that. But I mean, this is kind of standard quantum mechanical path integral, but very instructive, actually, to do it. Now, what other things did I want to say here? Okay, I mean, thinking in terms of an integration, of course, one immediate issue that arises here is that these are complex amplitudes. And, of course, saying anything about this expression really means discussing convergence properties of this object. But this is, of course, not this is not a good measure. I mean, you're here, I mean, summing over complex amplitudes, integrating over those. And one way, but there's a way of dealing with that, and a straightforward way for simple cases here, is to analytically continue it in such a manner that the integrand becomes real. And of course, once this is the case, I can just have a standard discussion of the convergence properties of this object. And that goes by the name of a Grick rotation. So the form this takes is just an analytic continuation in the time. So it's still fairly simple what you're doing. So in order to make this a well-defined computation, you analytically continue this entire construction to imaginary time. And that is usually called tau, also called Euclidean time sometimes, equal to I a t. Do your computation and then rotate back, right? Do your computation to find this propagator or Feynman kernel. And then be careful that when you rotate back, I mean, there are no singularities on the way in the complex plane. But this all works out here for the simple case. And this construction, I mean, in this Euclideanized construction, one obtains something that's called the Wiener measure. And one can actually have a careful mathematical treatment of this limit, which is kind of interesting. So where one specifies precisely the space of paths here in a mathematically clean way. And what is kind of curious when one does this, and you find this, for instance, done in, if you look at the relevant volume of Reed and Simon, they do this. One then sees that the path, so that's still an interesting question, the path that gives the main contribution to this functional integral, they are nowhere differentiable paths. So they are paths. What is a nowhere differentiable? Well, a non-differentiable point of a path is like a kink. And of course, these have all kinks. Huh? And if you now take a continuum limit, actually, so these paths will be just full of kinks. I mean, they will have just infinitely many kinks. And so there is a mathematical statement that specifies, you know, what type of path, in this generalized sense, you know, allowing for these non-differentiable points, contribute the most, or just contribute the bulk, are kind of form the carrier space where this integral is non-zero, has non-zero contributions. It's these nowhere differentiable paths. And that is initially surprising because you'd think, well, didn't, you know, one envisages that maybe the classical path gives you the major contribution. Strictly speaking, that is not true, although, of course, there are perturbative ways of calculating that where it just appears that the kind of the zeroth order contribution indeed comes from the classical path. But if I really think of that as, you know, coming from this non-perturbative construction, by non-perturbative, I mean, I'm doing the sum, and the path I'm summing over, integrating over, they can be arbitrarily far away from the classical path, right? What is the classical path? If my potential had been zero, the classical path would just be a straight line, okay? Now, this is not the case. Well, there could be some non-trivial potential. Nevertheless, it would be just a single a classical solution. But here, the paths that contribute here, and of course they're arbitrarily far away, because I'm integrating over arbitrary x position at any fixed time. Okay, so nevertheless, they conspire to give you the correct expression for this propagator. And of course, one thing that this propagator knows about, it also knows about a classical limit. So it knows also about kind of the classical path in a limit, say where the mass of the particle becomes big. Yeah. So it knows about this too. But what you see here at work, and there is no contradiction. So I want to say there is no contradiction with kind of physics. Because why is it no contradiction? Because the individual path histories, so the path or the histories you're summing over here, they are not individually observable quantities. So they're kind of virtual paths. So a contradiction would only arise kind of if you say, oh, each one of those is kind of real, but it's not, well, they're not real. They're real in a quantum mechanical sense that I'm superposing all of them in terms of amplitude, and they collectively give rise, well, to this propagator. But of course, what I have to look at in quantum mechanics are always observables, right? So I have always not just look at wave functions, and certainly not just look at this propagator as such, but see how it appears, how it contributes to observables, which of course are eigenvalues of suitable operators. And only those contain physical information. And clearly, this path integral, although it's certainly true what I said, the bulk of the contributions come from these highly, highly non-classical paths, it nevertheless manages to reproduce certainly the classical theory, but of course it gives you, in addition, kind of, if you like, all the quantum properties, all the quantum corrections, if you want to think of it perturbatively. So there is no contradiction here. And the reason why I'm emphasizing this so much is that in gravity, it seems that the perturbative quantum theory is not well defined. So if one does the path integral there, one is really faced with an infinite dimension analog, kind of really summing over all geometries. And again, the expectation you would then have is that actually the major contribution to a path integral comes in the end from geometries or space-time histories that are very, very non-classical. And this is actually borne out in specific examples, as we'll see. Now, in the remaining 10 minutes or so, let me now work my way towards quantum field theory, away from this quantum mechanical analysis. So here we've seen two contrasting ways, if you like, to solve the quantum mechanics of a non-relativistic particle. Either I do it the Schrödinger way, the canonical way, I work with these operators, self-adjoint operators, I construct my Hamiltonian, and I diagonalize it to find the eigenvalues. Alternatively, I can compute this object from this path integral prescription. And as I told you, when I have this object, it has exactly the same content, dynamical content. I mean, it contains everything I want to know about the quantum dynamics. So these are, well, they're distinct ways of doing the computation, but, well, they're complementary in a way. They're two sides of the same thing, just two ways of doing the computation. In quantum field theory, you also, in principle, have these two ways of computing things, and you should also think of them as complementary. So in particular, so this is now no longer quantum theory, but quantum field theory. So if you do things the path integral way, or covariantly, as one also says, that by this one usually means in a quantum field theory, one is not kind of breaking the thing up into space and time, as one has to do in the Hamiltonian formulation. So time is just one of the four space-time coordinates. One is not breaking Lorentz symmetry one keeps it manifest, as one says. So it has that exactly that advantage that the Lorentz invariance is manifest. What does it mean? The path integral is just set up in a way that everything has whatever Lorentz indices, right? And you contract things, and just the whole formalism is set up in a way to make maximal use of the symmetry properties, and that any object you write down has an immediately identifiable transformation behavior under your Lorentz transformations, huh? A certain tensorial character. So that's really what the formalism takes care of for you. So that is what one means by Lorentz invariant is manifest. You know, it's there, it stares you in the face, you know, you cannot possibly overlook it. By contrast, and why is this important? It's technically quite important. For instance, if you do perturbation theory and, you know, applying kind of the paraphernalia of kind of Feynman diagrams really relies on the fact that one works in this kind of explicitly invariant formalism, and also treating gauge symmetries that can all be done in this way. And it makes your life computationally quite simple. Now, I could do something else. I could make an explicit split, you know, of space-time into space and time. And then I would do my computation in a Hamiltonian formalism. So that is more analogous to what you do in standard quantum mechanics, where usually, I mean, the relativistic aspect doesn't play a role. I mean, often the context is just not relevant. It's the first approximation, non-relativistic. Now, so if you do things in the canonical way, that has also certain advantages, namely then you have the Hamiltonian given. And so that is one of the objects that naturally then appear here, as they did in the quantum mechanical context. And then just writing e to the, you know, minus I Hamiltonian times t, you have your unitary time evolution operator. So in that way of doing things, unitarity is manifest. And unitarity is, of course, also a property that your quantum field theory has, and you want to have it. That is kind of an essential thing. Unitarity is manifest. So it does not. Well, of course, what is not the case is that you're messing up with Lorentz invariance if you do things rightly. It's not the case. So you'll still, even if you do things canonically, you will still be able to identify what are the generators of my Lorentz transformation, my Poincaré transformation, and you'll just see what they do, say, on the wave functions that appear in this canonical formalism. And, of course, they should obey then the correct commutation relation. So everything is fine. It looks much more involved discussing anything to do with Lorentz invariance. It looks much more complicated. It's still there, but you have to work harder. And conversely, showing unitarity here sometimes can be a bit of a headache just to do it explicitly. So really, you should think of these two ways of, you know, doing your computation as complementary, also depending on the context, depending on the specific question you're trying to answer. One can be more convenient than the other. And often we want to keep Lorentz invariants explicit, and that is often the priority one has. Okay, now, after these wise remarks to be kept in mind, let me say just a very few things before wrapping up about the gravitational path integral. Yeah, maybe I should keep this lower line here. So what I wrote down here, see, was a path integral for a particle, you know, where I fixed 2 points, a non-relativistic particle. Now, formally, what is now the analog? What would I do for gravity? Of course, it's a quantum field theoretic integral, path integral. But of course, I have to ask myself, okay, what am I integrating over? What's the analog of the x of t? And the analog of the x of t is g mu nu of x. So a metric or a geometric configuration throughout space and time, if you like. So, okay, maybe I use this white blackboard here. So completely formally, what would my gravitational path integral look like? Formal, using continuum variables kind of to indicate what I want to do. So this situation is now something like that, well, kind of graphically illustrated. So again, of course, we're interested in evolution over time. Let us set aside, you know, what I mean by time for the moment, but, well, that's something clearly what I'm interested in dynamically. Now, what is the analog of a path? It's really a three-dimensional configuration, metric configuration, as it evolves in time. Okay? So a single path, let me kind of make a little drawing of what a single path is. So this is now a three-dimensional slice through my space-time here. This is, and I have made it compact. It's a compact circle in my way of drawing it. So I call that G3. That should mean a spatial geometry. So that is, you know, at time zero, say. Now I let this three-dimensional slice, I let this evolve in some way. It will curve and move and bend and what have you. And then I'll have a kind of an out geometry, boundary condition fixed at some other point in time. And this here, this is now a space-time geometry, so something like, you know, a G mu nu of x, and this was perhaps a Gij of x, just to indicate it's just spatial of x. So x is my four-dimensional x. Yeah, so this is now a path. Of course, a path is now an entire field configuration subject to certain boundary conditions. In the same way as this was one of my paths here. And the formal continuum expression is now this. Now I'm keeping track of the three-dimensional in and out geometries, so my initial and final condition, and making these square brackets indicates it's an equivalence class with respect to coordinate transformations already. So these should be the true physical degrees of freedom, Gij and Gij prime. So that is something my path integral will depend on. So what I'm doing now is I now integrate over all metrics, or rather geometries, equivalence classes, of four geometries with these, subject to these boundary conditions. So anything in between, so any path in between. And each one of them I weigh with e to the I, s, the gravitational action. So let me choose that just for definiteness, say as the Einstein-Hilbert action of G mu nu. And we already know that this only depends on the equivalence class. I mean, this way computing this complex weight depends only on the diffeomorphism equivalence class of G mu nu. So here, S Einstein-Hilbert is given by 1 divided by 16 pi Gn integral over M. Well, M is now this piece here, M, with the metric assignment G mu nu d for x, square root of the determinant r minus 2 lambda plus, in general, so this is a kind of a bulk term, a four-dimensional integral. In general, one will also have boundary terms. Let me just write them down for once. You'll meet them again probably in your GR course. So del M denotes the boundary of this piece of space-time. D3x square root of that H, so this is the induced spatial metric. Well, it's really what I mean by Gij here. And K is essentially it's a contraction of the extrinsic curvature. Let me not go into what these terms are. I hope they'll be explained to you in your other lectures. Just to alert you to the fact that in general, there will be such boundary terms. Often, well, you don't write them explicitly. They're understood that you need them. Now, so this G mu nu, as I said, is an equivalence class. Is a Diffeo equivalence class of metrics under this action of four-dimensional diffeomorphisms. And here, therefore, this configuration space, at least kind of morally speaking, is also an equivalence, a space of equivalence classes. Let me write it down here. It's Lorentzian metrics, kind of modulo, as one also says, the diffeomorphisms. So this just means I'm only counting, metrics once. I'm only counting one metric for each of these equivalent classes. So it's really over the true physical degrees of freedom. Now, so this, why do I call this formal? Because it's, if that was ill-defined for various reasons and I had to go through all kinds of, abracadabra to make this well-defined, this is so much more true for this quantum field theoretic integral. Of course, it's much worse. This is now a quantum field theoretic thing, so you already expect it to diverge anyway, from ultraviolet problems. You have to now think of how to parameterize this space, how to take care that, either you fix the gauge appropriately. So you have to really specify, what do you mean by this space? Can you have set up a limiting procedure like you did here? Is there a good analog of what I said was needed here, this Wick rotation? Is there any meaningful way in which this can ever be made into something that converges, maybe after choosing some regulators or cutoffs? How does it behave as I remove the cutoffs? I mean, there are kind of really zillions of questions, many more difficulties than were already present in the simple quantum mechanical path integral. And we'll be discussing some of them later on in the course and possible resolutions of that. But again, one additional feature is the presence of these gauge degrees of freedom, which already in the perturbative setting complicates your life somewhat, because even if you maybe had an idea of what this Lorentzian space is, space of Lorentzian metrics, this is in general, this is a kind of complicated space. And it's not clear, I mean, why should it be? For instance, a linear space. Yeah? Yeah.
I don't see how this is Lorentz.
No, this is not Lorentz invariant because I was talking about standard QFT on a Minkowskian background. So that would really be still valid, of course, for the perturbative gravitational path integral. What I've really done here, this didn't say anything about being perturbative. Really what I've here sketched is just the path integral in analogy with the path integral for the particle. And here I haven't yet specified that I would want to do a perturbative path integral. But so if I don't do that, there is no Lorentz or Poincaré symmetry that is simply not present. Nevertheless, the distinction is still that you're working with entire spacetimes. Whereas, if you did a Hamiltonian analysis, you would have to introduce a specific time slicing. And then you would have something like a Hamiltonian. And again, everything would look as spatial objects having a certain behavior as a function of time. But this is, at least to start with, this has a more covariant feel about it. So it's more space-time as opposed to space plus time. So, and that distinction, to some extent, persists here for gravity also.
But we have to choose like a surface to define.
Yeah, sure. But in principle, you might be able to do that, or you might be able to make some specific choice. What I want to say is, the essential quantity one would compute here is something like a propagator, right? Like this G, like the Feynman term. That's what one would compute here. Whereas if one does it the Hamiltonian way, what one looks at is Hamiltonian, or actually there it becomes a Hamiltonian constraint. So it looks, the formalisms do look quite different, and one can do it in simple toy examples. One can do all these things in two-dimensional quantum gravity. You can do both of these things, and they look very different, and you have, there's some work you have to do to show that they're one and the same. Okay, sorry for keeping you so long. That's the end of it, and I see you again tomorrow.